Time has no meaning.
Oh, my goodness. It's the Time Has No Meaning episode. That's why we're trapped. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
Welcome to Make Me Smart, where you're trapped in time.
You're trapped in time or unstuck in time, as I so often feel. The show about all things tech, economics, and culture. Unstuck in time is how you feel when you do your show a day ahead every day.
Oh, yeah. Speaking as the host of Marketplace Tech, which obviously everybody who listens to this should check out. This, however, is the show where we get smarter together because I guess we have to say it every time. None of us is as smart as all of us, even though I messed it up.
It never gets old.
All right, it gets a little old.
Hey,
what?
This news may come as a surprise. Midterm elections are quickly approaching. I know you probably have not heard a thing about this. Nevertheless, here they are. Some of you may have voted already. If you have not, please do. Because, as someone on the show likes to say a lot, elections have consequences.
Because they do. That's all I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking about these midterms, as everybody knows, for a very, very long time now. And what we're going to do today is talk about how people try to get their brains around elections, trying to figure out what is maybe possibly conceivably going to happen, what the temperature of the electorate is, as it were. And we're going to talk about polling. So I went out on Twitter this morning and I did a little election poll and I said, how much do you trust election polls? 75%, 50%, or 25%, or option four was, Kai, shut up. Twitter polls are stupid.
And so, I have your numbers for you.
I know. And okay, so go ahead. Give me the numbers.
You said, what's your confidence level in political polling? The 24% said 75%. Wow, this is going to be confusing. The vast majority of respondents so far, well, not the vast, but a plurality, said they have about a 50% confidence level in political polling. The next highest number said they're about 75% confident, and only 21% said that they have relatively low confidence.
Yeah. Which, you know.
So people are, you know, I feel like 50-50 is almost too meta at this point.
Well, yeah.
But
yeah,
people generally said, I'm about 50-50 on polls. And part of the reason for that, I think, is because as there is about so many of institutions, there's a lot of doubt around polls that grew after the 2016 election. Basically, people felt that the polls were telling them one thing would happen and that thing did not happen. And by that thing, we mean Hillary Clinton winning the presidential election. People felt that the polls misled them on who would become president. And then, of course, as with all things election, but particularly since 2016, because people have been trying to figure out what happened when they felt like they didn't know that was going to happen, we've been in this perpetual state of polling, trying to determine where the electorate stands as we head into the midterms. And we just wanted to talk about it. We wanted to get smarter about whether the polls were actually wrong, about how we interpret them, about how what we want to believe when we see them, and what we have learned about polling in the last 2 years.
So here's what we did. We called up Lynn Vavreck. She is a professor of political science at UCLA. She's a contributing columnist at The New York Times. She is also, just in happenstance, the author of a new book out called Identity Crisis, the 2016 Presidential Campaign and the Battle for the Meaning of America. I should tell you also, full disclosure, we had Lynn on a bunch of Marketplace roadshows that we did in 2014 for the midterms then. So we go back a ways. Lynn, it's so great to have you on.
It's so great to be here.
So holy cow, are you in your element now or what? Is this like your happiest time of year?
It is almost too much politics, even for those of us who do this for a living.
Well,
I'm sure.
It's nonstop.
Yeah, I'm sure. It seems like this conversation about poll, you know, I like to think that we are individual snowflakes with the genius of our ideas. But there is a large conversation happening about polling right now, because I think people are feeling like, despite the preponderance of polls, they have no idea what's going to happen next week. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that that's fair. And I think that people feel that way for all the reasons that you guys just talked about. The last time they thought they knew what was going to happen, something else happened. So people are updating. So I think that there's a lot of uncertainty out there and maybe anxiety. But that doesn't mean that there isn't value in the signal that polls are sending.
So I had a chat this morning with Larry Rosen, who runs polling at Edison Research, and they are polling partners in the Marketplace Edison Research economic survey that we do. And he had seen my tweet about people's confidence level in polls. And as you might remember from Molly's breakdown, I started with, how confident are you? 75%. And the first words out of his mouth when we spoke on the phone was, Jesus, where's 95% positive? So just so you know where he's coming from, and that's totally fair, and I get that. But what he wanted to do was sort of frame the 2016 thing for me, and he framed it this way. So look, national polls, the polling average basically was Hillary plus three, and she won the popular vote, Hillary plus two. And yet, just because of the way the Constitution's written, things turned out completely differently. And I wonder, Lynn, what your thoughts are on how people misinterpreted based on ex post facto results, if that makes any sense.
Well, I think that there's so much to talk about with respect to polling and 2016. But that first point that you just raised is kind of the most important. The national polls were accurate. They were more accurate in 2016 on average than they were in 2012. People just don't remember that because it happens to be that the person who they predicted would get more votes, who got more votes, actually didn't win the election. Now, that's also a failure of polling, but it's a failure of a different kind. So what we're talking about when we talk about the Electoral College is specific things that happened in three states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. But those state polls did miss. And so then a serious conversation has to happen around why in those states, take Michigan as an example, Michigan in particular, the polls really didn't see the pattern that was about to be revealed on election day. And that is an important moment for pollsters and campaign consultants and analysts to think about.
All right. So if I'm a relatively interested voter in this society and I want to have a sense of what's going on, what should I be looking at as I look at this just flood of polls out there?
Well, I think it depends on what question you're interested in answering. If you want to know
who's going to win, Lynn, that's what I want to know.
In your particular House race, or sort of like who's going to take the House, let's say.
That's a good distinction,
so
right?
It does matter. And this gets back to the difference between the nationwide polls in 2016 and those state polls. It's much harder to poll a small geography where you don't necessarily know the target demographics. You don't have a good sense maybe of whether Democrats in this part of the geography are the same as Democrats in this other part of geography, or they're different. So we know a lot about the nation as a whole. We've been polling the nation as a whole for a really long time. Yeah. Pollsters understand that problem. When you start to think about smaller geographies, whether that's states or congressional districts or municipalities, it gets harder and particularly challenging if in an election year, the candidates all of a sudden light up a dimension of politics that has typically not been a dimension on which elections are explicitly contested. And then maybe even within party, different parts of the state look really different. So that all gets very tricky for pollsters.
Mm-hmm. You wrote about this back in 2014, right? This idea that if the polls draw from the wrong sample of people, then even if the science is sound, you're talking to literally the wrong people.
Yeah, there are really only two problems to solve when you're writing a survey. Who are you going to ask and what are you going to ask them? And if I teach that to my undergraduates at UCLA, they think this is the simplest thing in the world. Yeah. I just have to answer these two challenges. But within each of those things, there are a million decisions that you have to make. And there's a set of best practices for each of those things. But when the world changes, when things get complicated, the best practices have to adapt. And in 2016, I think people didn't know it at the time, but they were finding themselves in a moment of change. And that's very easy to say in retrospect, but hard to know in real time.
So do you think, just to your point about candidates, shall we say, in this election cycle, having opened up a new dimension of politics, much as various norms are being disrupted in our political institutions, has President Trump blown up polling too?
I don't think so, because now, if you were polling in 2016 and you missed the Trump surge in Michigan or Wisconsin, yeah. Now you're updating and you're saying, boy, we don't want that to happen to us again. Yeah. And so now you won't necessarily, you know, you have to get X percent Democrats in your sample. Well, in the past, it didn't really matter if those Democrats came from this part of the state or that part of the state. But now, maybe you understand that it does matter. So you have another breakdown. You need some percentage of people of, you know, Democrats from the urban areas and then another percent of Democrats from rural areas so that it just is a makes it more complicated for you as a pollster. But you now have a better understanding of those differences and you'll adapt.
Let's talk about like the nuts and bolts for a second, just how it is actually done, right? Because there's a lot of it still done by landline, and then you have these millennials who aren't on landlines, but you need cell phones and texting and internet surveys, but it sounds like you also need in-person polling. Like, how much is that a little bit of a third leg when you talk about those two things, which is what are you going to ask and who are you going to ask? Is there a how are you going to ask that can affect the results significantly too?
There's definitely a how, and that is an area where things are really changing and a lot of innovation is happening. So if you've been following at the Upshot, Nate Cohn has been live polling.
Yeah, that's super cool, actually.
I think one of the most interesting things that I've heard people talk about in reading about that effort, people cannot believe the response rate on these polls that are done on the telephone. And so if you're listening, just take a guess. What percent of people do you think respond to a phone poll? And whatever your number is, I guarantee you it's too big. Yeah. Because in some cases, Nate is writing that it's 1%, it's 2%. So the response to these random phone call polls has really fallen. It used to be you could do that in the 1960s and 70s. Yeah. You'd get 50, 60%. So the industry has really had to adapt to that in all the ways that you just talked about, Molly. So cell phones are another complication, and they adapted. So you would have one process where you wanted to get a random and therefore representative sample of landline houses and people in those houses. And then you'd have another process where you would randomly get a representative sample of mobile phone users. And you have some idea from the census of how much of the population is a landline household and how much is a cell phone only household. Mm-hmm. So you know how to mix those things together. As long as you have a target, and the census is really almost always what we're talking about, so you know how to combine people, you can do pretty well, even as the technology and people's habits change.
Hmm. Can we talk also about the partisan skew in some polls? The president's favorite poll, obviously, is Rasmussen. It leans Republican. There are more liberal Democratic polls out there. What is one to do?
Well, I know that it is not popular to defend polling, but I'm going to do it. So
you go.
What is one to do in exactly this case? This is where there's real value in the kind of work that Nate Silver pioneered at 538, that many, many other people have gone on to do, poll aggregating. People think of them as forecasters. They're forecasting the outcome, but they're actually doing something much more interesting than that. If everybody could just not think of them as forecasting and think of them as poll aggregating. And so basically they're taking all of those individual polls that you just talked about, one leans right, one leans left, the other one's always off by 6 points, whatever the pattern is for that particular house. So a house is a survey firm. Mm-hmm. And those poll aggregators are going to take all those polls and they're going to say, okay, let's filter out. Let's use all available polls that this house has ever done. Let's filter out the house effect. And that's the number that they're giving you. There's real value in that. And I think it's, you know, people want to hate on them because they say, you know, oh, they told us that this candidate was going to win and that candidate, and yeah. I believed that. And then they lost and it's all Nate Silver's fault. You know, that's really not productive.
Because we think you're forecasting, right? We think you're saying, here's what's going to happen. It's going to rain tomorrow. Okay.
And they do say that.
I was just going to say, it sounds like the weather. Right. It really does. Like, you can see why everybody's mad because they think of it like the weather.
They are doing that. They are forecasting, but it's not all they're doing, you know, and people are not good. You know, the Upshot did this in 2016, and I thought did a, you know, full disclosure, you know, I write for them, but I thought they did a nice job of trying to help people understand the uncertainty in a forecast. And so they did things like the probability that so-and-so is going to win today is X. That's about the same chance that an average NBA player has to make the free throw when they go to the line. Or that's about the chance that a field goal kicker has from 38 yards. And people know, God, sometimes those people miss. You know, like when your team's down by three and the field goal guy goes up there from 30, you think to yourself, well, God, I hope he makes it, because you know he might not. But in politics, when they said, you know, Hillary Clinton has about the same chance to win as the field goal, everyone thought it's a it's a sure thing.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, so here, this is kind of a meta evil cycle question. But if trust in polls decline, could that lead to worse participation? Could that actually then long-term impact the overall accuracy of the polls because people are either not participating or not telling the truth or just not wanting to play, taking their ball and going home, to keep on the sports metaphor?
I think it's charming to think that might happen. And I kind of wish it were true, because it would mean that at some point people were taking it seriously. But I think really where we are is that so few people who are called to participate in surveys and polls actually participate. That 1%, 2%, I don't think that those people are going to stop participating because they have lost faith in polling. They are only participating still because they think it's in some way a reasonable thing to do. So I doubt that the change in how polling is perceived writ large is going to affect who's answering these questions.
So here comes a really dicey question, and it's a little bit a la John Stewart on Crossfire, lo these many years ago. Would democracy be better off if we didn't have polls, if everybody just voted and then we figured out what happened ex post facto?
I don't think so.
How come?
I think that there's information, important information, in the polls. And, you know, what we can't do anything about the fact that people might take that information and not process it fully, like think that that means Hillary Clinton's ahead, she's for sure going to win. We can't worry about that. What I worry about is not having information about the state of the race out there for people who are genuinely interested in how things are going. And I don't want to say that coverage on who's ahead and who's behind is more important than coverage of policy. It's not. There should be more coverage of policy and what candidates want to do. But the fact is that people want to read the stories. They want to listen to the podcasts about who's ahead and who's behind. And they don't want to listen to the podcasts about the nuances of policy differences between the two candidates on college education. So I think that more information is always better, and I want the polling information to be out there and for people to know this race is close or this race is not close. And so if you're going to volunteer, maybe you go volunteer for a different candidate, one where the election looks like it's a real squeaker. I think that's all good.
All right. Lynn Vavreck, she's a professor of political science at UCLA, also contributes to the New York Times, and she's got a book out. It's called Identity Crisis, the 2016 Presidential Campaign, and the Battle for the Meaning of America. That's a big title, man. No pressure on that one to deliver, huh? Holy
cow. Check it out.
Lynn, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Be good. Bye-bye.
All right. That was fascinating. And the last part made me feel kind of bad. Like, dang, maybe I should get a landline and like participate in polls, which
That's
is
so funny.
This teeny percent.
We're thinking about getting rid of our landline because we literally never answer it because it's all robocalls and spam and BS. And the odds that I'm going to participate in a political poll are zero, I will tell you.
I know. And that, I mean, that still, that raises like 10 to 100 more questions, which is super interesting.
Right.
But yes,
right.
Once I realized that my landline was voice over IP and not a good old fashioned POTS line and would not save me in an earthquake, I dumped it.
Oh, you know, ours is VoIP too.
They all
wow.
are now. Like, it's a story that we need to do, which is basically like, as an emergency device, our landlines are useless.
Great. Great.
Thanks for nothing, Internet.
Avenue of Despair from Molly Wood. Speaking of which, we'll get to that in a minute. But now, we got to go do some stuff. Email us, let us know your thoughts about polling or Molly's phone line or whatever. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Here comes some music. Bye.
We recently heard from Larissa in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who wrote to tell us that Make Me Smart is the highlight of her week. She especially appreciates how we tie policy, economics, and social and economic theory into a thoughtful, digestible conversation. Thanks, Larissa. If you want to keep Make Me Smart going strong, like Larissa does, please join her in donating online at marketplace.org. And thank you so much to all the Marketplace investors who make our work possible.
Oh, so this is interesting. I was going to cheat by looking at my computer screen, which can tell me when the file is going to end, the audio file. But it actually, there's a little bit of white.
And you distracted yourself?
I distracted myself and I blew it. But also, there's a little bit of empty space on the end of that file. So the sound stopped when there was still a second left. So
cheating
does not do you any good. All right. So anyway, we're back. and look, we're going to do something a little bit fun now. I tend to take us to a dark place every now and then. And I'm going to do that again in a minute, actually, when we get to the fixation. Sometimes it just happens. And we talk about some gloomy stuff sometimes. Privacy in homes and VR devices tracking your movements and, you know, nothing mattering. You know, all of that. We do that.
Nothing mattering.
And it happens.
It does happen. And that is when you hear the Kai sigh. And sometimes, yep, there it
that
is.
That was real, by the way. That was just me doing that.
Because it's just because why wouldn't you? I agree. Oh my God, that was an accident. Anyway, sometimes you just have to acknowledge the sentiment. And I have been strongly, because I am not subtle, hinting that I would love a way to signal when we enter that place, the dark place. For podcasts, that often means a sound, a signature sound, which we call a sting here in Radioland, to show that we are entering the dark place. And as you do, you wonderful listeners, you contributed some. Some of these may have come from the engineers. I don't know how many of them came from you and how many did not.
But we're gonna play some.
We have multiple options. And what are we going to do? We're going to vote or we're going to see if we
like
them?
I don't know what we're going to do. We're going to play them and then you and I are going to talk about them. And then I think we're going to let people vote. But I don't even know.
Okay.
All right. So here's option number one. It is a nod to the weird things you find on YouTube. Here you go.
You are about to enter the world of my imagination. You are entering my dark place.
Oh, God, no.
That's terrible, man.
Oh, God.
No,
so
that
80s,
one's not an option. If you like that one,
I don't
too
like that
bad,
guy at
because
all.
You're going to be vetoed. Okay.
He stole our idea, too.
All right, number two. Here.
Our idea. We're the only ones who ever referred to anything as a dark place.
Oh, that's not bad.
Oh.
Appropriate length.
Oh, I like that.
Very moody.
And there's a little bit of like tumbleweed,
so
like
kind
of Western
one.
Movie.
I don't mind that one.
I like it.
Okay, all right. Here's option three.
Aw, it's just, you know, sadness.
It's a little minor key, a lilting piano. What is that?
It's a little too pretty. It's a little too pretty.
If I have to wait for it in a sting, then it takes too long.
It's too long.
What?
The Dark Place.
Oh, Charlton Thorpe getting the cameo there. Yeah, still no.
Oh, dang it.
Still no.
Came all the way around, but yes, we had to wait too long.
Okay. A sting that lasts 18 seconds is practically a bridge, people. And we'll do
that's
a glossary,
a
I suppose, of radio terms. But anyway.
Ooh, look at you.
I know,
it's
right?
practically a bridge, you guys.
I've been doing this for a long time.
We did get, okay, here's a listener one. Aaron Swain sent us this one, which is 4 seconds and therefore an actual sting.
Aaron, man, I love you, but that ain't it.
It's kind of Stranger Things, which is not bad.
Well, Stranger Things, as we know, I don't watch scary things, so I don't watch Stranger Things. But anyway.
My kid wants to have like a marathon Stranger Things watching party, and I'm like, that sounds cool, except for how you're not going to go to bed.
Yeah, and also how you're not going to do it. So, you know, anyway. All right, so look, here's what I think we're going to do. We played you four. I personally have ruled out three of them. Molly may have a different point of view. Okay.
Nope, same.
So here's what I think we need to do. We need to open it up for submissions, right? I mean, we might as well own this. If we're going to do it, we might as well own it. So look, a couple of things. Sting means short. We're talking like 4 to 6 seconds, tops, tops, tops. I don't know what senior producer Eve Tro was thinking with 18 seconds worth of Sting. What is that? So there's that. So it's got to be short. And email them to us. Do a sound file. Do whatever you want. But my preference right now is that emo sounding one. Can we hit that one again? Yeah. Here we go. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was not bad. I don't mind that one. I don't mind that one. Anyway, let that inform your judgment. Email them to us. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. And we'll do this again maybe in a couple of weeks. And then we'll decide.
Yeah, loving it.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to decide, honestly. I don't think we're opening this up.
Sorry, guys.
Host's prerogative.
But the good news is that more than likely one of you will have created the sting that we ultimately choose, possibly. And then that's a win.
Maybe, kind of.
Okay.
Anyway,
so, maybe, possibly.
Do we have things to do? We got to go. All right.
Email us. All we right. do. We have a real sting.
Okay.
The fixation fix
yes.
one.
So, last week, as we'll remember, I did a little grammar, a little part of speech. My part of speech was credulous. It's an adjective, means too easily believing of things. And it was something that the press had done in relationship to the president and something, yes, I'm going to say it, ridiculous that he said that the press just printed and said, listen, it was the tax cut. The president said, I'm going to get a tax cut before the election, right? And without any hint of reality-based thinking in that. I'm going to stick with that trend of parts of speech, and my part of speech this week is distraction. It's a noun, a thing that prevents someone from giving full attention to something else. And I say that because of the news to the drop this morning, and that's in that Axios interview that the president did, in which he said he, by executive order, is going to get rid of birthright citizenship in the United States. Now, I am not a lawyer, and lawyers will disagree on this, but the idea that he's going to do that by an executive order and then just having that credulously reprinted by the person interviewing him and further media outlets this morning is, to me, a distraction from the purpose of the media. That's it. That's all I got. Mm-hmm. Play the dark sting right here. Just hit it. Yes, yes, yes. Oh, that's so good. You guys are ready for it.
That's amazing. Yeah. They totally were. They were like, go for it.
On the ball. Anyway, so that's mine. That's it. That's all I got. I apologize for not thinking of that before we actually printed and copied the rundown. But anyway.
I have to be honest. I thought you might go there with that one today because of last week and the sheer credulous ninniness of it.
It's insane. Uh-huh. And look, we're being played. We are being played. Played, 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 played. And we fall for it every time.
Every time. Every time. I have three options to choose from, and I want someone to vote.
Did you not read the rules?
To choose from, and I like want someone to pick one because they're all so good.
I'm going to
point
you
quickly. Okay, I have one on polling.
Uh-huh.
I have one on how elections have consequences.
Did that?
And I have a report from my field trip.
Ooh, you took a field trip?
Which has trivia? Yeah.
Oh, let's do that one.
Okay, trivia.
Okay.
Okay, so last week I went on a field trip. I know, this is good. Let's do this every time because you know I can't choose.
Yes.
So thank you.
Oh, man, there was a lot in that little sentence right there. But anyway, let us move on.
Help. Last week, I took a field trip to the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, National Laboratory, where, I've never been, which was amazing. And it was for the dedication of the newest supercomputer. At Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, which is called Sierra. And it, like, the last time one was installed was 2005 or something like that.
Okay.
So it was super interesting. And it was like the first time I got to meet a supercomputer, which is fascinating, right? Because they're still the size of an entire room.
Really?
Super huge.
You'd think they'd be smaller than that.
I mean, they're getting smaller. Like, I guess the last one was, or the one in 1994 or something, was 6,000 square feet.
Yeah.
And this is now maybe a 3,000 square foot room that has multiple supercomputer installations in there. But so what a couple of things were interesting about this. One, just the sheer supercomputer factor. And then, and I'm not going to geek out on this too much, but they're building these computers in a new way that will make them more easily able to integrate increasingly smart artificial intelligence.
Wow.
So like they're integrating different kinds of chips and they're architecting these things in a way that allows them to do more like thinking style analysis, simulations, and then draw analysis.
Do we want computers to be thinking? At supercomputing speed? I'm not sure we do.
At supercomputing speed. And then here's the trivia part, because I just didn't realize that this machine, Sierra, and then there's a non-classified, like way smaller version of the machine that can be used for open computing. So just science, like cancer medicine and all, you know, climate change research.
Right. And we should say, actually, just to back up for a second, they need classified stuff at Lawrence Livermore because they do nuclear theoretical testing and it's a national lab and they do all kinds of high tech stuff. Yeah.
So that's exactly the part that I learned about that I didn't know. What I didn't realize is that this like $300 million computer essentially exists to run simulations on the rate of decay and the potential yield. And maybe although they don't say this because classified, the potential yield of like a nuke that may or may not be in development in North Korea. But like this computer literally exists to like maintain and simulate things about our nuclear stockpile.
So we don't have to do them in the atmosphere is the deal. That's the deal.
Well, yeah, exactly. So that there's no underground or above ground testing and we don't explode things. And we make sure that they're not going to like explode somewhere in their bunkers. You know, they simulate what's happening with the physics inside the nukes. But it just seemed like a huge infrastructure to support this other huge infrastructure that's all about nuclear weapons. And somehow I found that just really profound. Consider that my report from the field trip.
Consider it reported.
Yeah.
All right. Another sting here. Is that where we're going? Another sting. It's a real one, too. Oh, no, it's actually not a sting, actually.
Dear Make Me Smart.
My name's Jessica from Austin.
This is Stephen Gillivray from Fountain Hills, Arizona.
This is Sandra Bond in Newport, Oregon.
You know how it's not a sting? It lasts a really long time.
Sting.
That's how you know it's not a sting.
Says
I'm just
sting
saying.
In the
I'm
file
just saying.
Name.
Stings are not long. So college tuition. Hello. Got lots of feedback. One quick clarification, though, on that episode. At the top of the thing, we interviewed students from Minds Matter LA about their top college choices, and they all listed private schools, which is relevant. So while those are their top choices for college, those are not the only schools those kids are applying to. All three are applying to a range of schools, 8 to 12 apiece, which includes a lot of public schools. So that's important to know. Your thoughts now on this tuition episode. Rob Mathewson left us this voice memo on how he navigated the college financial process with his kids.
When it came time to look at this, I helped each of them to work out their personal budgets for their first year after school. From there, I put this question to each of them. If you want to go to this fancy university and accept the responsibility of paying back these loans, then you tell me why you think you can earn the extra money that's going to be necessary for you to pay off these loans and live a life that allows you to succeed. Needless to say, both my boys are going to public schools, out-of-state public schools, but public schools nonetheless. And I think at the end of the day, they're probably going to be as happy professionally and certainly happier from a financial standpoint.
That's such a dad voicemail. That's such a dad voicemail. David Bradley posted this message in our Facebook group and then left us a voice memo version of it, probably because Shara asked him to, which was awesome.
When I worked in higher education, I heard stories of a dean of a college for 7 years with a $300,000 salary who was allowed to retire at 80%, maintain his tenure, only have to teach one class, and had 5 TAs to do it. Recently, our college university stadium had a $300 million expansion paid for by public bonds. But student fees went up, and so did the price of tickets. So what I'm curious to understand is what the colleges are actually spending their money on.
Climbing walls and physical fitness centers and hotel-style dormitories. I mean, you don't have to dig too deep to read about some of the luxury items that a lot of these schools are putting in. It's true.
Yeah, I mean, that's like a version of the question we all ask about government, right? I don't know. I already pay you a lot of taxes. What are you spending it on? Why do you need more? It feels like the same talk.
Yeah. Totally, totally. Sam Reber had another idea on how students can reduce their college tuition debt. Here you go.
A lot of people usually end up switching majors or going into a totally different line of work than what they studied in college. High school seniors are betting so much on a decision made at 18 years old that will probably change a year or two down the line. Maybe we should start teaching high schoolers to take a look at their local community college, figure out what they actually want to do, and save money taking generals. Then make a more sound decision on college and financial debt after a couple years of community college. Love the show and all the varied topics.
Yeah, totally fair point. Totally fair point.
That is, I mean, it's a super fair point. And all of that, it's funny because even to, hold on, where's our dad? Rob. Even to Rob's point, like so much of this is even the pricing based on this idea of prestige, that you will have doors opened for you because you have Princeton as part of your last name or Yale as part of your last name. Or a friend of mine went to Harvard. She calls it the H-bomb whenever she drops it.
But then she always says, I went to school in Boston, right?
And she does. She totally does. And she's like, I don't want to hit people with the H-bomb up and, you know, unless I really have to. But that stuff still matters. And until we can get over those psychological barriers, then all of these very reasonable conversations are still really hard to have, I think. All right, now it is time for the Make Me Smart question. That question, of course, being what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? David Detlefson posted on our Facebook group.
Hi, Molly and Kai. I've been thinking about my answer to the Make Me Smart question for about a year, and I finally have one. I used to think that Election Day was the day you had to vote. I now know that Election Day is the deadline for voting. Polls are already open for early voting in many states, including mine in Illinois. What do you think would be the effects on voter turnout if we stopped referring to the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November as Election Day and started referring to it as the voting period deadline? Thanks for a great podcast.
So that's a totally great point, although I do have a whole riff on this, and it goes very briefly like this. I think Election Day in a democracy ought to be a community event, right? And I think we ought to give people the day off. We ought to spend money to get as many polling stations as we need. And we should all actually go to the polls and do it as a communal experience of democracy. And I understand that there's lots of flaws with what's going on now. And forget even about like disenfranchisement and voter suppression, but just the logistics and the hardware of the voting establishment in this country are insufficient to meet the demand, which is why we have vote by mail and voting over a period of time and all that jazz. But I think actually it's a loss to this society that we don't actually exercise our right to vote as a communal experience. End of rant.
Yeah, I would love to see a hybrid. Like, there could definitely be both, right?
Nope,
make it a federal holiday.
Nope.
And do the big...
I only go one way. Sorry.
Okay. All right. But you know it's going to become like a shopping holiday, like Labor Day, and people are still going to have to work. So I want it to work. Right. Also, you know, if we called it the voter period deadline, then everybody would just procrastinate and they would assume that we were going to somehow move the deadline back.
Yeah, totally. What Molly said. There's another way. There's another way to stay in touch with us. And if you've got, and I'm not going to do it because we got yelled at last time we did this. If you've got an Amazon Echo device in your home and you want to hear from me and or Molly, actually, no, it's me or Molly because we've never done any of these together. But we do a thing on the Amazon Echo device, which has a name, which I won't say. But all you have to do is say the name of that device and then Make Me Smart. And Molly or I will pop up with an interesting tidbit or fact or relevant current event and some information about it.
Sometimes they're even not relevant, which is also fine. Currently, sometimes they're a little rando. There was a great tweet about it that was like, these are our workshop explainers remind me. She was like, this is like me at every party. Like, don't say something random. Don't just say something random. But we get to, we have candy, electronic voting, Halloween stores, daylight savings, all kinds of stuff. That's on our ballot, by the way. We get to vote in California on whether to have daylight savings.
Do you think it's actually going to go away? Do you think it's going to pass? I wonder what the poll... Oh, here we go, full circle. I wonder what the polling on this proposition says.
Well, also, even if we all passed it, it has to like go to Congress and get signed by the president. And he would probably just be like, nope, California, hate it. Let's be honest. All right. That's what would happen.
Anywho, now would be a convenient time for the music to start. Oh, man.
It's true, though.
Oh, man. Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Morris. Senior producer is Eve Troh, she of the 18 Second Sting. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostet. Our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday. Was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
And they say, I'm the unsubtle one. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. Deborah Clark is the one who's going to have to buy me a new laptop. Sorry, Deb. Sorry about that.
Gotta listen all the way to the end, boss.
Very exciting episode.
That will explain the expense that's about to show up on your desk.
Surprise! New MacBook Pros were announced today. I also like a Surface.
I know. We can get one of those. Laptop. Anyway. Oh,
awkward.
Gotta go. Bye.
Bye.
There we go.